This is Continuous Coverage.
Continuous Coverage.
Continuous Coverage.
In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill from the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hidden Killers Podcast.
That is where we're going to be picking up here. Segment number three in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill. Let's take a listen.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Please be seated. Okay, we're back on the record on CR 22-21-1624, State of Idaho versus Lori Noreen Vallow. The state continues with its case in chief. Mr. Wright, you've previously been sworn and are still under oath for your testimony this afternoon. Ms. Blake, you can continue with your direct examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. And just for the benefit of the jurors, before we broke for lunch, we'd been talking about a new device that was activated on October 9th. And is it correct that the device normally associated with Alex Cox, or most often associated with him, had remained at his residence as far as any data location on the night of October 9th?
Yes, that's correct.
And then this new device became active, and there were the text messages with a device associated with Chad Daybill between 7:13 and 10:30?
Yes, that's correct.
And then with regard to the month of October, did you look at some additional location data?
Yes, I did.
Were there some specific days or a date that you focused on?
I observed some activity between October 16th and October 18th where the device left Rexburg area and went to Las Vegas.
And could you determine an endpoint in Las Vegas or one of the stops at least there?
Yes. So it left on the 16th and from Lori Vallow's address, 175. It went to the Comfort Inn and Suites in Hurricane, Utah, along I-15. And it stopped there for the night. And then the device continued on into McCarran International Airport, which is now Harry Reid International Airport. It was there on Thursday, October 17th, 2019. It was there from 1356 to 1410, and then it drove back from that point back to Rexburg. There were some other stops on this trip, but like gas and restaurants and things like that, but the trip was fairly continuous other than the overnight.
And did the trip have any relevance that you determined to the investigation?
Yes.
And what was that?
That Lori Vallow had taken a flight from Las Vegas on the 17th.
And did the date of Friday, October 18th, become important in the investigation?
Yes.
And why was that?
The night of the 18th into the 19th was the night that Tammy Daybill died.
And can you describe what we're seeing on this particular slide?
So on the on the afternoon of the 18th, the device had left the apartments at 565 Pioneer Road and drove south to Idaho Falls. It was there for the afternoon at a few different locations, but the last location was in the vicinity of the Chick-fil-A at 1958 to about 2132. It's in or around that Chick-fil-A area in Ammon, Idaho. At around 2132, it drives north from Ammon, Idaho, towards Rexburg. It actually bypasses the normal exit to go to Alex Cox's residence and continues north towards the Daybill residence. So this map is an overhead view of Rexburg is in the southern part of this map. the Daybell residence is this pin on the north part of the map. And this is part of that trip back from Ammon, Idaho, and Idaho Falls area, back up towards the Daybell residence. So at 2205, approximately, it's near this interchange exit on Highway 20. And then it continues north to this area. It says Salem right there, but right at that intersection of Salem Road, and I think it's Salem Church Road is the east-west road. There's a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints chapel there, and the device stays in that area for a period of time. And there's a period of time when we receive data, and then there's a period of time when we receive no data. And then the next data point that appears is that after this period of no data is a data point at 2353. We get a data point right here. That's actually a Wi-Fi hit of about 110-meter radius. And starting at that point, there continues to be data after that, regular data, as the device actually doesn't go back to Rexburg. It continues on south of Rexburg to back to Idaho Falls.
Did the device remain in Idaho Falls for the duration of that night? Could you tell?
Yes, it appeared to go to a hotel in Idaho Falls, a Hilton Garden, there and stay the night.
At that point, do you know if Alex Cox still had the apartment or the residence at Pioneer, on Pioneer Road?
Yes, on subsequent nights, he stayed in 107 on Pioneer Road.
And with regard to that Chick-fil-A notation, do you recall the receipt that some of the receipts that we looked at earlier that were recovered from that Jeep?
Yes.
Did the receipt recovered regarding Chick-fil-A on Friday, October 18th, did it appear to fall within that time frame?
Yes, it was October 18th at 8:05 or 20:05 from that same Chick-fil-A.
And if we look at this next slide, can you describe what we're seeing in this one?
So this is part of that same map, but just zoomed in. And this shows the spot where the device seems lingers in this area here. This is the LDS Church here. This is the Daybell residence on the north part of the map. The distance between those two points along Salem Road is about 2.6 miles. And it stays in this area beginning at 2207. And we get 38 minutes of data points. And then there's an hour and a half of no data before we get that data point back on Highway 20 as it's heading south.
And through your investigation, did you learn of Alex Cox knowing anyone else in that area besides Chad Daybell?
No, we did not identify anyone else that he knew in that area other than Chad Daybell.
And in this next slide, can you describe what we're seeing here?
So this is a zoomed-in view of that LDS chapel at, this is Salem Road, and I think this is Salem Church Road, and at 3462 North Salem Road. And the first data points are on the left, and we get two at 2207. And at least one of those is a GPS coordinate. And then for the next,
I'm sorry. Can we have him please talk into the microphone? I'm really having a hard time hearing him.
Okay.
So the next data points are over here, and these are Wi-Fi data points. We get a total of 16 data points between 2207 and 2245 before we stop receiving any more data for a period of time. I think the previous slide shows that margin of error. The one two slides back shows what the margin was on those Wi-Fi data points. Yes, there it is. So these 16 points ranged from some were GPS and some were Wi-Fi, 11-meter radius to 122-meter radius are those 16 data points that we saw populated. Some appear on the house, some appear by the church. So at 2245, there isn't any more data from there until 2353, when that data point appears on Highway 20 heading south. And then again, there's regular data after that as it continues on to Idaho Falls. The distance from the church to the point where we get that first data point after the period of no data at 2353 is about a 7-minute drive. So if the device was in a vehicle traveling on the highway, it maybe would have left, if it had come from this spot, we don't know, but an estimate is maybe it left at 2346, roughly, deduct 7 minutes from 2353, could give you an idea of the span of time. But we just don't know where the device is for an hour and 8 minutes, other than it does appear just south of this location again.
And when we see the data points on that residence located next to the church, are those data points within a radius that the vehicle or the device could have been in the church parking lot?
Yes.
And with regard, I think this is what you were referencing as well, but is this just depicting again those times?
Yes, correct. That's that same information I just mentioned.
And through your investigation, you reviewed the data location for the month of October, is that correct, of 2019?
Yes.
Is this a summary of the times that a device or that device was in the vicinity or at the Daybell residence?
Yes, during the month of October, I identified three dates that it seemed to go into the vicinity of the Daybell residence. The first one was October 9th, which I talked about previously, when it doesn't seem to stop at the residence. It just drives up to the intersection near the residence, drives east to Highway 20, turns around and drives back by the residence before driving south back to Alex Cox's residence. On October 15th, 2019, it went to the residence again between 1341 and 1356, about 15 minutes. These data points were in the front or area of the residence. There weren't any data points anywhere else on the property. They just seemed to be near the front of the residence. And then on Friday, October 18th, 2019, it drives to that church, which is 2.6 miles south of the Daybell residence. None of the data that I saw for the 18th showed that device going closer than 2.6 miles or going up to the actual Daybell residence.
Thank you. If I may have just a moment, Your Honor.
You may.
Your Honor, I do not have any additional questions. I do have the jump drive to admit as the actual exhibit. The court already has the printed out slides.
Very well. We'll have that admitted as the jump drive with the PowerPoint presentation.
And it is exhibit 299 for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Blake. That'll conclude the direct examination then. Mr. Thomas, are you conducting cross?
I am, Judge.
Very well.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wright.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. So it looks like you Went to the FBI Academy in 1997, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that after you went to college? Did you go to college?
I did.
And was that prior to 1997?
Yes.
Okay. Where did you go to school?
Southern Utah University.
Okay. And then was this your first job out of college?
I worked for a manufacturing company while I was in college at the same time I was going to school.
Okay. And was this your first job out of college, though, after the
pretty much, yes.
Okay. You indicate that you did your last 11 years in Denver in the violent crimes unit, crimes against children, is that right?
Yes.
And that was 2007 to 2018?
Yes.
And then at what point did you become a contract special investigator?
I've been doing that a little over a year.
Oh, from today?
Yes.
I see. So you were
special. So after my retirement, I came on as a contractor doing some investigative work for the FBI.
Okay. So you were a special agent during the time of most of this investigation, is that right?
Yes, from the start of the FBI investigation in November of 2019, when I was first notified, I was the case agent until my retirement at the end of August of 2021.
Okay, so you retired in August of 2021?
Yes.
And then you just couldn't stay away? Had to start doing some consulting?
Pretty much, yeah. All I do now is just background investigations on security clearances, government employee security clearances. I'm not doing criminal investigations anymore.
Gotcha. And are you still working out of the Pocatello office, or are you at a different office?
I still reside in Pocatello, but most of my work, I don't have to go into the office.
Okay. But is it field type work where you go out?
Yeah, exactly. They send me work orders for interviews for these background investigations. I conduct them and I submit them.
Okay.
I can work
from
home. All
right, Mr. Wright, Mr. Thomas, too. We need to make sure you don't speak over each other, please.
Right. I apologize, Judge. I'm sorry. All right. Okay. So you were the case agent from November of 2019 to August of 2021. Is that right?
Yes. There was one other agent assigned, but yes.
Okay. Who became the case agent after you left?
So Travis Homer, who was the other case agent and worked with me, he continued on as the case agent. I don't know if there were any more after that, if he was the only one assigned.
Okay. So you testify that you had some interaction with Ian Pawlowski, is that right?
Yes.
Do you recall when that was?
I first met him on December 5th of 2019. He came to the Rexburg Police Department and he was interviewed. I sat in on that first interview. There was another follow-up interview, I believe, the following day, but I was not present for that one.
Okay. And at some point, you were kind of the liaison between him and the law enforcement agencies, is that right?
I probably was the primary. He was communicating with Detective Ray Hermosillo as well, but I interacted with him over a period of about almost a month. We had several communications and discussions.
Okay. So when he was wearing a wire, well, I shouldn't say it's a wire. It was some sort of a listening device or?
Yes. I don't remember. It was some kind of concealment device that he could record with, and the Rexburg Police Department had that device and gave that to him.
Okay, and so when he had possession of that device, you were his main contact to either download the information or get that information. Is that correct?
That's fair to say. One of them. He may have been in communication with Ray Hermosillo, but I did communicate with him about the device, and I also, on at least multiple occasions, retrieved that device and gave it to Detective Hermosillo so they could take the recordings into custody.
Okay. All right. So there was some talk of you dealing with your Nick Balance, who is the member of the cast team. Is that correct?
Yes.
And he gave you some specific dates or you asked him to give you some specific dates between September 1 and September 30th, 2019. Is that correct?
Yes. He had provided dates in the investigation based on what he was reviewing. But he's reviewing, he works on a lot of different cases for different people to assist case agents like me. So he's helping me by feeding me stuff of potential interest. But eventually it got to the point that although it was helpful, I wanted to see it all. And that's where he provided a file for September of 2019. And I started going through it myself to see if I could see anything else that hadn't been, had been overlooked. Mm-hmm. And then I did it again later for the month of October.
Okay. And I believe you mentioned a couple of times that you were seeing patterns, or you were things were outside of what you would call a pattern. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
All right. And so how long, I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been a special agent for a long time, done a lot of surveillance, I'm sure. How long does it take for you to develop enough data where you can have a pattern on a particular person?
In general terms or in this specific case?
Well, let's talk general terms first, and then we'll go specifics.
If I saw something happen every day for a week at a certain time or a certain place, I would sort of think that's a pattern that they do that at a certain time or place. Okay. In this case, I only had those 3 months to really analyze. I mean, those 2 months to really look at. So when I say a pattern, it's based only on that information.
Okay. I guess there's a difference between having a pattern. If you're a college student, you see that person leave their house at 9 a.m. They go to a particular building on a particular campus at 9:15. They come out at 11 o'clock. They come home, there's a specific pattern.
Yes, especially for somebody that's going to school or employed. They generally are arriving roughly the same time, leaving the same time. In this case, we didn't see those kind of patterns. He didn't appear to have employment or anything like that. So what he did in a given day, it varied quite a bit from a day to day.
So when you say pattern, I mean, that, especially in this particular context, it's kind of a loose term. Like, there's really not a pattern, right?
So I believe when I mention pattern, at least the one I'm thinking of is where it went at night. And I think I just detailed what I saw, which was in the month of September, at least, from the time it first appeared at 107 through the end of the month, it went to 107 during those particular hours in the middle of the night.
Okay. And you're just talking about the cell
phone. So for my pattern is, though, what is that 25-day period it did that?
Okay. So. But it's kind of hard to come up with a real pattern based on a 25-day period, right?
Sure. Okay. I mean, that's the extent of my knowledge.
Okay. And all the data points that you got were for Alex Cox, right?
Yes, that device, that's the one I reviewed. Now, there are other devices that were being looked at, but to my understanding of the investigation, the other ones did not have the extent of location information as this particular device and Google account did.
Okay. And as far as your PowerPoint and all the things that you went through today, they were all just Alex Cox's information?
Exactly. Just that one phone number and just that one Google account.
Okay. Didn't have any information on Lori Vallow?
Correct.
Didn't know when she, you didn't know her pattern, she didn't have a pattern?
No, I did not look at that, and especially what I talked about was not referring to any device that she had other than that one photograph that I mentioned came from an iCloud account for her.
Okay. And you mentioned that you use some mapping software for the GPS data that you were receiving. Is that correct?
Yes. So that was in the format that... Go on. I'll let you ask your question. Sorry.
I just kind of want to know what was the mapping software that you were using?
So Nick Balance took those data points. He's getting all the raw data from the carrier, from Google, and he imported that into a Google Earth file. So that's all I did. I didn't create the mapping software. I didn't use anything other than what he provided, which was this Google Earth file that those points are mapped in. And then these images we saw today were literally still shots from the same mapping software that I looked at. That's the exact thing. That's the same thing I looked at. Other than in the actual file, you can click on individual data points and pull up additional information, underlying data.
Okay. So you use the Google mapping software. There are other mapping softwares out there, right?
Oh, yes, sure.
And you could take these same raw data and plug them into other mapping softwares, correct?
Yes, you should be able to.
And you can see if the mapping software from Google would match up with the other mapping software.
Sure, yes.
To have a real precise way of telling a jury, hey, I'm sure that this particular data point is correct and it is within 4 meters or however many meters, because I not only put it in the Google software, I put it into an independent software, a different software.
Sure, yes.
And you didn't do that?
I did not do that.
And Dick Balance didn't do that?
I don't know if he did or not.
Okay, but you would have known.
He has additional training and experience that and expertise that I do not have, so the extent of his analysis is it's beyond what I know how to do.
Right. But between
And
between,
I don't know exactly what those tools and techniques are.
Okay. But between 2019 and 2021, you were the case agent?
Yes, I was.
And you would have known if he would have put something into a different software. I mean, the buck stops with you. You're the case agent, right?
Objection, Your Honor, this has been asked and answered. I know counsel's going for a different answer, but it's been asked and answered.
I'll overrule it at this point.
Okay. Could you ask your question again, please?
Sure. Basically, I was saying that you're the case agent, and so the information stops with you, and that you are the one who would know if this was entered into a different software.
I know that he used some kind of other software and prepared a report for that. I do know that. And I have seen that report, and it looks different than the software I use, the Google Earth. I don't know what that software is. At the time, I was still the case agent. His report was still in draft form. It was an ongoing project, and at different times he would share, this is kind of where I'm at, but the final product is yet to come. And so where his final product ended up and what that looked like, I don't know, because I was retired by that point.
Okay. But during your time, there was nobody that came to you that said, hey, I mapped these in Google, and I mapped them in an independent one, and they came up the same.
Like I said, he was putting it into some kind of mapping software. So I had seen that, and it looks different. I just don't know exactly what it is. He was doing that.
So the data points could be different?
No, that they were different. I'm not sure what you're asking.
You're saying that the mapping software could have come up with different results with these two different...
Oh, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying that he was using different software than he provided to me in that Google Earth file to do his analysis.
Okay.
You'd have to ask him what that was.
Sure, we'll be sure to do that. On September 23rd, you said that the phone that Alex had, this particular phone, was at Chad Daybell's house between 9:55 and 10:12 a.m., and then it leaves the residence. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. On September 23rd, is that what you said?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And in your, based on your training, based on your experience, based on all of your knowledge that you have of 20-some-odd years of working with the FBI, that's not enough time to dig a hole, dig a grave, chop up roots around that particular hole or grave, find boards and find stones, and cover the grave up in that 17-minute window?
I was there when JJ was found, and I've seen that grave, and it looked like it would take a lot more work than 17 minutes to have dug that and covered it.
Okay. Thank you. There was some talk about where this particular phone was that belonged to Alex Cox, where it was on different dates. On August the 9th, do you recall where Lori Vallow was on that particular day?
August 9th or?
October 9th.
Oh, October 9th. I do. My understanding is she was not in town. She was traveling, from the investigation, yes.
Going to Arizona?
I think she was in Arizona and then Missouri.
Okay.
I don't know exactly if the 9th, which one of those places she was at.
All right. And on October the 18th, when Tammy Daybell died, do you remember where Lori might have been on that particular day?
My understanding is she was in Hawaii or either in transit to or from Hawaii.
Okay. If I could have just a second, Judge.
Yes.
Your Honor, we have no further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Any redirect?
You were asked a lot about whether or not you use different software from Agent Balance. And you indicated you did use the Google software, correct?
Yes, I used the same software he provided the document in, or the data in.
And that was how he provided it to you?
Correct. He created that file.
And did you, in fact, conduct additional investigation regarding those data points? And what I'm referencing is, on September 8th, a photo was recovered placing Alex Cox in West Yellowstone. Is that correct?
Correct. There was other investigation being conducted to help corroborate the data that was being found in the devices.
Yep. And on several dates, you found data to corroborate that Alex Cox was in the same location as his device was showing to be.
Correct.
And when you're doing data location, you're just talking about the location of the device itself.
Correct.
And the known user of the device you reviewed was Alex Cox.
Correct, but I couldn't say at all times that he had the device, just that it was attributed to him, and there was evidence that he did carry that device, but whether he had it all the time, I couldn't say.
And what you've talked about today is not a review of phone calls or text messages between Alex Cox and anyone else, is that correct?
Correct.
You're just talking about the location data associated with that.
Correct.
So as far as any communications he may or may not have had with Lori or Chad during this time, outside of the 10 text messages that were referenced, you did not get into those communications?
Correct. I was not reviewing his call detail records in depth like that. There was an analyst assisting, as well as Nick Balance was looking that up, I'm aware.
You were also asked about how long it would maybe take to dig, or about the grave that was located, and if 17 minutes was enough time to dig that grave. In your opinion, would 17 minutes be enough time for one person to dig that grave?
I don't think so. I don't think so. It looked, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I think it would have taken one person longer than that to have dug that.
So could more than one person have been involved in digging that grave?
Yes, or potentially.
Objection. Calls for speculation, Judge.
Overruled.
Yeah, it potentially could have been done quicker with more people or equipment. Or when I say 17 minutes, that's the time the device is there, not necessarily that the grave was dug then or dug prior to that. I don't know. I can't say that. This is the time when the device was there.
So at this point, there'd be no way to know whether or not there was more than one person involved in digging that grave just based on the data location that you have.
Based on the data location, I can only say there's a device there at the grave site.
No further questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Blake. I'll conclude then the testimony of this witness. Can the witness be released?
We would ask that the witness be released from the subpoena, Your Honor.
Any objection?
No objection, Judge.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. The bailiff will help assist you out of the courtroom. State can call its next witness.
Your Honor, if we could have just a brief sidebar.
Yes. All right, once you're ready, Ms. Blake, then the state can call their next witness.
Your Honor, the state will call Dr. Eric Christensen.
All right, now that the witness is sworn, before we get started with testimony, let me just inquire briefly. Dr. Christensen, have you reviewed any of the trial testimony in this case, either by reading it or listening to it in any means, either through the internet or observing it at any of the viewing locations?
No, I have not.
Okay, thank you for your response. When you're testifying, please talk directly into that microphone, and please use verbal responses to answer any questions so we make a clear record, and also try to avoid speaking at the same time as anyone questioning you. With that in mind then, Ms. Blake, you can inquire on your direct examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Would you please state your name and spell your name for the record?
Sure. Eric Christensen. It's E-R-I-K, last name C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N.
What is your current occupation?
I'm currently employed as a forensic pathologist by the Utah Department of Health and Human Services, where I serve as the chief medical examiner for the state of Utah.
And is your title doctor?
Yes.
What experience, well, actually, let me back up. What education do you have in order to hold the position you have?
Sure. I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy that I attended then medical school at the University of Virginia. Following my medical school training, I did an internship in pediatrics at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and then subsequent to that did pathology residency training in anatomic and clinical pathology. Following completion of that training, I spent some time as a hospital-based pathologist for a couple of years prior to doing a specific fellowship training in forensic pathology. And since that time, I've been employed as a forensic pathologist.
And can you explain a little bit about what a pathologist in general is?
Sure. Pathology is a specialty of medicine, just like internal medicine or pediatrics or surgery, that is aimed at the making diagnoses of conditions based on the evaluation and analysis of either fluid samples or tissue samples or cell samples, and also by means of an autopsy. All of those things fall under the purview of pathologists. For example, if you go have blood drawn, all of that blood is run in a hospital lab that is directed and supervised by a pathologist. If you have a biopsy of something taken to find out if it's cancerous or infectious or whatever, all of those things are evaluated by pathologists to make a determination as to what the diagnosis is. And then autopsies are also done by pathologists to determine cause of death.
And if you, in conducting autopsies, is that a special branch of pathology? Is that the forensic pathology?
So the performance of autopsies is part and parcel of anatomic pathology. To be a forensic pathologist, you are required to first have board certification and training in anatomic pathology, and then subsequently receive special training in forensic pathology, which is aimed at the evaluation of sudden, unexpected, and non-natural deaths, things that typically fall to the jurisdiction of either a medical examiner or a coroner.
Have you worked as a forensic pathologist in other locations than Salt Lake?
Yes, I have.
And where else have you worked as a forensic pathologist?
I've worked as a forensic pathologist in Virginia as well as South Carolina prior to moving to Utah.
And with regard to your work in Utah, can you tell us a little bit? Actually, let me back up. In Utah, with regard to a death certificate, who is it that would determine the cause and manner of death?
So in Utah, the system is such that for most deaths in the state.
I'm going to object. I don't think this is relevant to this case. He's dealing with Utah.
Ms. Blake, response.
Your Honor, I think it goes to his training and experience and what his job duties are within the state of Utah. While he conducted an autopsy for the state of Idaho, I think it is relevant.
For foundational purposes, then, I'll overrule that objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. Who in Utah is the person that determines the cause of death or manner of death on a death certificate?
Sure. For cases that do not fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner in Utah, that would be just whoever the person's primary care doctor or attending physician was if they're a hospitalized patient. For deaths that occur and fall to the jurisdiction of the medical examiner, which is about 20% of the deaths in the state of Utah, all of those death certificates are signed by our staff of 10 forensic pathologists.
In Utah, do they employ the coroner system?
No. No. Coroners, there's a lot of regional variability as to how that happens throughout the country. Some states, like Idaho, South Carolina, other places that I'm familiar with, have at each county has a coroner who's assigned to elected to investigate deaths that are sudden, unexpected, and non-natural. Some states have moved to institute a medical examiner system instead of a coroner system. In some states, that's done on a statewide basis, as it is in Utah. Some places, it's done on a county-by-county basis, where there may be some of the larger counties in a state, for example, may have a medical examiner, but the smaller jurisdictions may still have elected coroners.
Have you previously worked in systems that have the coroner, or in states, excuse me, that have the coroner system in place?
Yes.
And in those jurisdictions, a coroner is separate from a forensic pathologist, correct?
That's correct.
And as a forensic pathologist, you've talked about the background and training and education you have to have. In your experience, do coroners require that same training and experience?
No, they're not required to have that. Most places, the statutory requirements to be the coroner is obviously you have to be elected, but then you also have to be a registered voter, usually in the county where you're elected, can't have any felony convictions. But there's beyond that, no general specific requirements, although that varies a little bit from state to state.
And do you know approximately how many autopsies you have conducted at this point in your career?
Around 7,200.
Did you end up conducting an autopsy on an individual named Tamara or Tammy Daybell?
Yes.
Do you recall approximately when you became involved in the process of starting the autopsy?
Yes. Well, the autopsy itself was done on December 11th, following a disinterment order from the district court. But our office's initial involvement in that process was probably in November of 2019. We were approached by someone from Fremont County with questions about that process. And so we provided some guidance on how that would be required to proceed.
And did you, in fact, attend the exhumation of Tammy Daybell's body?
I did.
And were you present when her body was transported, or excuse me, was loaded for transportation to your office?
Yes.
Did you see her her casket loaded into the transportation vehicle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were you also present at your office when the body arrived?
Yes.
When a body is exhumed, is it common for you or someone from your office to attend that exhumation?
Yes, that's fairly routine. There are a lot of different reasons that exhumations might be done. Sometimes it's to allow for the collection of DNA samples in a case, older case, for example, where DNA technology was not what it is now. Sometimes it's just for logistical reasons. A family wants to move a person from one place to another. They may or may not have had an autopsy or a death certificate previously, and so we get involved in those cases to certify the death. And then sometimes it's for evaluation of potential criminal circumstances.
And does your office do more than just conduct the autopsy itself?
In the process of investigating a death that comes to our jurisdiction, we spend a lot of time both upfront to the extent that we can and very frequently for an extended period after the examination is complete gathering information, and that is sort of usually in the form of medical records, police records, interview statements, other information that is available that helps us understand the circumstances surrounding the person's death. It's somewhat like when you go see your doctor, for example. You don't just walk in. He doesn't just do an exam and say, here's what we're doing. He talks to you. He gathers information from you about what your symptoms have been, how long they've been going on, have they gotten worse, are they getting better, all of those kinds of things. And obviously, we can't speak to our patients, but that information gathering for us in that realm happens through records review and talking to people who knew what was going on with that person.
And with regard to Tammy Daybell, did you, in fact, obtain some records to review?
Yes.
And did you speak with individuals already involved in an investigation?
Yes, we did.
Did you do that? Did you do some of that prior to actually performing the autopsy?
Yes. In the setting of an exhumation or disinterment case, it's a little bit unique in the sense that it can be planned out a little bit more, and so we can gather information before that disinterment and the subsequent examination happens. In this case, we did have the ability to gather some information from Fremont County, from both the sheriff's office and the coroner's office as to their investigation of Tammy's death up to that, to the point that she was released for burial and transported to Utah. And so we did have some of that information. Then obviously subsequent to the exam, we gathered a lot of additional information, which we also reviewed.
And is that common practice for how your office handles the full process of the autopsy or investigation?
Yes, that's pretty typical.
Are exhumations very common in your experience?
No. I've been involved with, over the course of my career, a dozen or two at the most. I mean, it's not out of 7,200 autopsies, it's not a common occurrence.
And when you performed the autopsy of Tammy Daybell, was anyone else present with you?
At that time, she was a trainee in our office, Dr. Lily Marsden, who's a board-certified pathologist who was at that point specifically in our office to train as a forensic pathologist. She was involved in the examination with me, and then in the course of an autopsy, we have members of our autopsy staff that are there for taking photographs, helping us collect samples and evidence, and other items that we deem that we need to collect. And then and sometimes there are also law enforcement personnel present. In this case, I believe the coroner from Fremont County was present for the examination, as was Lieutenant Powell. I can't recall who else off the top of my head.
And did you and Dr. Marsden conduct this autopsy in conjunction with each other?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And did you discuss the findings as you were conducting the autopsy?
Yes, both as we conducted it and discussed them frequently as we were finalizing the report and opinion.
If a body is exhumed, does that make it so that an autopsy is more difficult to be performed, or does it change how you would perform an autopsy?
So the primary differences in the setting of a disinterred or exhumed body, most of the time those people have been embalmed already, which changes the nature of their tissues. It has all been what we refer to as fixed because of the embalming fluid, makes it somewhat more stiff. and a little less pliable, but it also preserves it. And so it's a little more difficult to do the exam just because of the stiffness of the body and the tissues, but it's something that we do on a fairly regular basis, even on cases where there was not a disinterment, because funeral homes as a practice tend to embalm bodies fairly quickly once they receive custody of the person. And sometimes bodies will go get embalmed before somebody realizes that they need to come to us for an examination. So we have quite a lot of experience dealing with embalmed bodies, less with disinterred bodies, but the process is basically the same. The only other difference with a disinterred body really has more to do with the nature of the the burial and the preservation. If in this case the vault in which her casket was preserved was dry and well maintained, and so there wasn't a lot of water or other damage, which we sometimes encounter. There was also her embalming was pretty good, and it had also not been a long period of time since she had been interred, and all of those things can make a difference. The only real finding related to her burial that was still present besides the embalming was the growth of some mold in various places on her body.
Can you walk us through how an autopsy is conducted?
Sure. So an autopsy examination in a forensic context is a medical procedure that is aimed at evaluating the presence or absence of injuries, presence or absence of natural disease. We collect samples for toxicology, so we know what intoxicants may or may not have played a role in the death. All of those things are done. Generally, we begin with an external examination, which involves a detailed examination of the body as it arrives. Excuse me. We then take photographs all along the way of the body with clothing. Then clothing is removed. If there are visible injuries, those are photographed both before they are cleaned and then after they're cleaned. And any trace evidence that might be present, we collect at that point as well. Once we are done with the external surfaces of the body, both front and back, we then proceed with an internal examination, looking at all of the organs from the brain to the rectum and everything in between to evaluate them for their any pathologic or disease process that might be present. And at that time, we also collect samples that can be used for toxicology testing. There are some settings where we do additional dissections, looking at different parts of the soft tissue. For example, sometimes we'll do a layered neck dissection where we evaluate the various layers of musculature in the neck, looking for evidence of injury. And there's other specialized exams that we will do in some cases, not every case. We also generally will take x-rays of the body to evaluate for the presence of implanted hardware, skeletal trauma, both older and new, and any other information that might be yielded from the from an x-ray examination. Sometimes that also discloses natural disease that we can see. So all of those things are done, and then we collect samples also during the course of the autopsy to look at under the microscope so that we can assess even if an organ looks normal, for example. Sometimes under the microscope it may not be normal, and so we look at tissue samples that way. We also take time to look at injuries under the microscope in some cases, because they can also provide us information about how old an injury is. You know, how long has it been there? Certainly nothing to the degree of precision that you see on TV where somebody says this person died at, 5:37 last night, but we can, through that sort of analysis, allow for a sort of a broad swath of time. Did this injury happen around the time of death? Is it more than a few hours old? Is it days old? Is it weeks old?
And in conducting the autopsy on Tammy Daybell, did you in fact reach a conclusion as to the cause and manner of death?
Yes, we did.
And what were those?
We determined her cause of death to be the result of asphyxia, and her manner of death to be homicide.
And when you use the term homicide, can you talk about what that means in terms of your office?
Sure. So we did not certify Tammy's death in terms of signing the death certificate because she didn't die in Utah, but we make the same determination. The determination of manner of death, we have basically five options that are on the death certificate. A death can be determined to be natural, it can be suicide, it can be accident, or it can be a homicide. And then there's a fifth option where you can determine it. You can just say, we can't determine. We can't decide between which of these options it is, depending on the nature of the case. That determination is an administrative function that is performed for vital records purposes, is recorded on the death certificate, and is used to broadly categorize the types of deaths that happen in a given location, so that, efforts can be made to try and prevent different types of death and be aware of the different categories and classes of deaths that happen in a non-natural way.
And when you talk about the term asphyxia, can you tell the jury what you mean by that term?
Sure. Asphyxiation is simply a process by which a person is deprived of oxygen. They're not allowed to breathe or intake sufficient oxygen to allow their life to continue. And that can be by any number of different means. Asphyxia is a very broad category that includes deaths from, technically drowning is an asphyxial death. Any kind of suffocation or smothering is an asphyxial death. Hanging deaths tend to be asphyxial deaths. And there are also chemical asphyxiants. Carbon monoxide, for example, impairs person's ability to use oxygen. But broadly speaking, we use that term to apply to cases where someone is unable to get sufficient oxygen into their system to allow them to continue living.
And you talked a little bit about how the process of an autopsy. With regard to Tammy Daybell, did you see any external injuries or any obvious injuries that would have been the cause of her death?
No.
Can you walk us through how you ended up reaching your conclusion regarding homicide and asphyxiation?
Sure. Asphyxiation as a cause of death is really a diagnosis of exclusion. It requires that you have evaluated other possible causes of death and excluded them as contributing to the death. Essentially, in this case, and many cases like it, you have what we would term a mostly negative autopsy, meaning there's no pathology, no natural disease, and no evident injuries that are visible at autopsy that would explain why this person died. And most asphyxial deaths fall into that category as well. There are a limited number of things that can cause deaths without leaving any changes that are visible in the body as to why the person died. And some of those are natural, some of them are non-natural. In this case, the two primary natural causes that, can result in this sort of change are seizures. Someone can certainly have a seizure and die from seizures. Generally speaking, we see that in the setting of people with known seizure disorder. And in this case, we didn't have any history. There was certainly some history related to us that she may have had some seizure-like activity in the days prior to her death, but no medical evaluation that we could find for any of those symptoms, no indication that she had a diagnosis of epilepsy. It would also be quite unusual for a woman at her age to suddenly develop seizures out of the blue, having her very first ever epileptic seizure occur at that age. It certainly does happen sometimes, but it's certainly more common in an older person to be a man, and it's also more common for that to occur in the setting of some other brain pathology, for example, like a stroke was new, something changed in the brain, or the slow growth over time of a brain tumor. That's, for example, how John McCain, Ted Kennedy, and others that had brain tumors, some of their initial symptoms were seizures. And so that you know, again, she did not have any of that. Her brain was totally normal. And so for that to be her cause of death just is very, very unlikely. So we have excluded that on that basis. Other things that can cause, you know, natural causes of a sudden death with no findings at autopsy would be arrhythmia disorders, rhythm disturbances. Your heart, in addition to being a pump, is also an electrical organ, and it is driven by the electrical circuits within it. And if those circuits get short-circuited, so to say, that can lead to a sudden death in an individual as well. There are a number of inherited disorders associated with genes that make the channels that cause ions to flow in the heart that make that electrical circuitry work the way it's supposed to. People that have those inherited disorders can die suddenly and unexpectedly. Generally speaking, the people that have inherited forms of that will also have some family history of that, although not always. But most of the time, there will be some history of that. And it would also be unusual for it to occur, again, at her age. Mostly that type of change presents in childhood or young adulthood. So neither of those things is very likely given that. As far as non-natural causes of death, asphyxia, obviously, I've told you that's what we concluded led to her death. There, you know, are any number of ways that someone can be asphyxiated. That can be from, you know, suffocation, which is just a broad description of anything that occludes the external airway. Can also be the result of neck compression or chest compression. Any of those things that impair someone's ability to breathe normally, even if they, if their mouth is not occluded, certainly can also lead to their death. Things that occlude the mouth tend to act more quickly, in the sense if you adequately, you know, block someone's ability to breathe at all by occluding their nose and mouth, they would lose consciousness, very quickly, a matter of, 15 or 20 seconds, if that occlusion is effectively held in place, and then that may or may not lead to their immediate death. They may continue to have, after loss of consciousness, may continue to have heartbeat for some period of time, but end up with what is called central apnea, meaning the changes to the brain have impaired their ability to breathe normally. So even if the occlusion is released, they may not breathe normally after that. So asphyxia is certainly one possibility in this case. Other non-natural things that could potentially account for her death would be any kind of chemical intoxication or drug overdose. We looked at, in this case, an extensive array of drugs, medications, pesticides, chemical weapons agents, lots of things, way beyond what we normally look at, and found no indication of anything in her system except for a what would be considered therapeutic level of medication fluoxetine, which she had been taking for many years, and no indication that that played a role in her death. That substance has been associated with some cardiac rhythm or abnormalities as well, but no indication that that played a role in her death. And so those are the sort of the basic things. She, in addition to having, no anatomical abnormalities, no organ pathology per se, no pneumonia, no other pathologic process that would explain her death, she did also have some injuries on her arms, very nonspecific blunt injuries, bruises on her right arm, left arm, and on her left chest, which were determined to be relatively acute injuries, had happened, within the hours around the time of her death. Would be, by their nature, those types of blunt injuries are not specific, but they are certainly consistent with someone being restrained, and would be, consistent with asphyxia as a cause of death as well.
And if we break some of that down a little bit, because you've indicated that the autopsy in this case is a negative autopsy because there is not a clear way to determine the cause of death. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you talked about one of the other potentials being seizures.
Correct.
Can seizure activity, and could you explain a little bit about what a seizure is?
A seizure is abnormal electrical activity in the brain that causes, can manifest in a variety of ways. What we might typically think of as generalized or convulsive seizures. Someone would collapse and have shaking movements for a period of time after a period of stiffness. People can also have what are called partial seizures that result in staring spells or other types of inattention or movements, abnormal movements of parts of the body. Any of those types of seizure disorder are potentially put the person at risk for sudden death.
Have you conducted autopsies before where there is evidence of seizure activity?
Yes. You certainly don't have to have anything. You may not have any evidence at autopsy, like I said, in the setting of a seizure, but sometimes we do see things, for example, like tongue injuries if the person bites their tongue. And that can be both, acute injuries or healing injuries. We sometimes also see evidence of incontinence of either bowel or bladder occurring at or around the time of death. But those are, soft signs, not really, they're not definitive for seizures, but they are sometimes associated with seizures.
And you did talk about that it would be uncommon for someone Tammy's age to have all of a sudden developed seizures or started having seizures.
Yes.
And do you know how old she was?
49.
You also talked about there was really no evidence of her having seizure-like activity outside of some information provided. Was that information that you reviewed provided by Chad Daybell?
I believe that's where the coroner said that information came from, yes.
So it came to you through the coroner, but was reported as having come from Chad Daybell?
Yes.
Did you review some medical records for Tammy Daybell as part of your investigation?
Yes, we did.
Did you see anything in the medical records that would support Tammy having seizure-like activity?
No.
Is that part of why... is that part of your conclusion that it would be unlikely she died from a seizure?
It contributes to that, yes.
And then you talked about arrhythmia. I think you said arrhythmia irregularities. I may have that wrong, but essentially something with the heart. Mm-hmm. And I believe you talked about, would it be similar because of Tammy's age, you wouldn't expect to see that a sudden onset of problems with the heart?
Certainly, I mean, middle age and older is a common time for people to develop heart disease. And that can also include arrhythmias or rhythm disturbances such as heart block and other things like that. But generally, those do not present with sudden death. They'll present with palpitations or other things like that. In the setting of what we call the channelopathies, the inherited or potentially acquired conditions that lead to lethal rhythm disturbances where a person has ventricular fibrillation, which is incompatible with life, those conditions do tend to be inherited and do tend to present at a much younger age than what she was.
And then just to go over it as well, it sounded like one of the other causes that could result in a negative autopsy would be some kind of an intoxicant.
Yes.
Can you sometimes see signs of someone dying of an intoxicant?
Certainly there are a number of things that we see, and drugs that lead to death or substances that lead to death by intoxication tend to lead to death by one of two means. I mean, all of us, when we die, ultimately our heart stops and our breathing stops. And so it's generally the medication or the substance has an action on one of those things. Opiates, for example, and other central nervous system depressant agents tend to suppress breathing. They either slow your breathing down or stop it, which then leads to, once your breathing is inadequate, will ultimately lead to your heart stopping. Other medications are directly toxic to the heart. But things, any of those types of suppressant medications that lead, or depressant medications rather, that lead to respiratory failure, also lead to what is called pulmonary edema, which is the presence of fluid buildup within the lungs, which sometimes then also is visible externally as it comes up the airways and out in the setting of a fatal intoxication.
When you talk about intoxicants, does that also include what would commonly be known or referred to as poisons?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about doing some testing for intoxicants, and so that would encompass poison as well?
Yes. I mean, there is no such thing, for example, as the ability to test for every possible substance. Toxicology labs just sort of generally are not structured that way. It's the lab that we use does a very broad screening for hundreds of the more common, and even many of those are not very common, but hundreds of the more common illicit drugs, over-the-counter drugs, and prescription medications to see are they present or are they not. In addition, in this case, we also looked at, heavy metals, lead, arsenic, selenium, and other things that are known to be intoxicants. We looked at organophosphate pesticides to see if there was anything there that could potentially lead to her death. Looked at cyanide. Had our chemical threat laboratory at the Utah Public Health Laboratory do some testing for both additional organophosphate poisons, nerve agents that are generally seen only in the context of chemical weapons attacks. None of those were found. We also had them test for a couple of different biologic toxins, ricin and abrin, both of which were also not detected. So we did a lot more testing in this case than we generally do in most cases, but all of it was negative except for the medication that she was prescribed.
And did you, in fact, was more than one agency involved with the testing, the toxicology testing?
Yes. So in addition to the chemical threat lab, the rest of the testing was done at National Medical Services Lab, which is a reference laboratory that we use in Pennsylvania.
And I believe you indicated this is one of the most extensive toxicology testings that you've been involved in with regards to an autopsy?
Yes.
And was the reason for that because it was a negative autopsy?
Yes. And because of the suspicious circumstances surrounding the death.
When you do testing for substances, intoxicants, and the other things that we've talked about, what part of the body or what do you generally try to test with?
In most cases, the optimal, substance for testing is blood. That gives us an indication of what is going on in that person at the time of their death, what's circulating through their system. In her case, because she had been embalmed, blood is not available for us to use for testing. And so in cases like that, whether it's because of prior embalming or because of decomposition, there's any number of reasons we do this, but we will send liver samples to be tested, mostly because those there are pretty good reference ranges for postmortem testing in liver tissue.
And in your opinion, did the fact that Tammy was embalmed inhibit the ability to test for those substances?
It didn't inhibit it. It slowed it down some. We had to certainly do some redirection on a few things, but it didn't. It did not change things ultimately, no.
Was there anything from the toxicology testing that stood out to you?
No, other than her, the presence of her medication at a therapeutic or what would be considered a normal level, everything, there was not an intoxication, a toxicologic explanation for her death.
And, Your Honor, I'm going to ask if I can get Exhibits 295A to L that were previously admitted.
Mr. Bailiff, sorry, could I just briefly look at those? It'll be quicker for me to...
I'd like to see them, too.
All right, counsel, I'm going to go ahead and suggest we take the mid-afternoon break, and then we'll get into the exhibits and pictures. If that works for you, I apologize to interrupt, but we're right about the correct...
No, I think that'll work right now.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Blake.
All right, please.
That wraps up segment number three of our continuous coverage on the trial of Lori Vallow-Daybell today. There's more to come. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
This is continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
In the trial of Lori Vallow-Daybell from the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hidden Killers Podcast.